Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and we're going to talk again about the Kingdom of God. The Kingdom of God is a vast subject. It will cover almost every kind of topic that would be of interest to man or woman. And today we're going to talk about men a lot. We're going to talk about husband. But we're going to talk about a lot of things that people are just not used to thinking about in ways, at least, that they're not used to thinking about them. And the reason that it's going to be a challenge to some people is because of a thing that we've been popularizing here is the term cognitive dissonance. We actually have something we call TCD, is terminal cognitive dissonance. That means that you have this cognitive dissonance that you just can't overcome. It's terminal. You're going to be one of those zombies, those dead people that Jesus talked about when he said, let the dead bury the dead. Because they just don't get it. They just don't, they will not receive eyes to see or ears to hear. It takes a person willing to do some serious soul searching, looking retrospectively and introspectively upon yourself and why you are what you are. Now, we're not trying to beat you up. We're not trying to humiliate people. We're not trying to make people suffer. We're trying to awaken people patiently and calmly. And sometimes we have to do a little shouting to get people to understand how important this is. But everything is tied up in mankind, in the relationship of man and woman. And men and women have built into them opposing forces that will strengthen them. There's something called isometrics that is used in exercise where you pit one of your muscles against another muscle. And it strengthens the muscle, except for the fact that there's a level that you can reach in pitting one muscle against another muscle, because this muscle is only so strong. You pit against that muscle, it's only so strong. You have to create an external force to strengthen one muscle more than the other so that isometrics will continue to increase the muscle power of both opposing muscles. And this is kind of the way it is with husband and wife. Husband and wife are two distinct muscles. They do different things. They are very similar. They're both muscles. They're both connected to the same arm, but in different ways. And when you pit one against the other, they strengthen one another. They don't become the other muscle. They just both become stronger by pitting themselves against each other. One in the pendant muscle isometrics, one muscle is always stronger in one sense, but the other one is a part of the operation. Without one, you know, you can only bend your arm one way. You can't bend it back. And so there's this parallel between man and woman, that they're not the same. They come from different points of view. They are both muscles, but they do something different. And if they interact properly, they strengthen one another. When you bring in an outside force, something external from the husband and wife, this creates an additional stress upon one muscle or the other, so that that muscle, when again introduced into the process of isometrics, they strengthen more, because this outside force has put stress on one muscle, strengthened it, and then now that one brings that stress and strengthening to the original isometric muscle, and you improve the muscle tone of both by that interaction. So I don't know, that's an analogy maybe a little bit beyond some people to understand, but the point is that, what would Shakespeare say something about in Much Ado About Nothing, to test what manner of metal a man is made out of. And that's one of the positions of a woman, to test the man, to strengthen the man. It's not right that man be alone, that a woman will test and test to see what metal that man is made out of by her nature. She doesn't even have to try. It's just by her nature she will do that. And most men would be very surprised as to where one of the major tests in the structure of that personality we call woman is upon a man. And we'll get to that eventually, but we're not going to start with that. We're going to start with Genesis 3:16, where it says, "Unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrows, and thy conception in sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee." Now, that's a terribly misunderstood quote in the Bible. It's supposed to be because the woman had been deceived and deceived her husband, and they fell in the sin. And these are talking about personality characteristics that are found in every man and every woman. And because they chose to go a certain way, certain things are going to follow. It's like if you choose to have a leader who can exercise authority one over the other and rule over you, to fight your battles for you, to make things right, to guarantee justice, to guarantee security, certain things will follow. And Samuel lists them out, that he will end up taking. Then he will rule over you and take your sons and daughters and all this kind of stuff. He'll make his instruments of war. He'll bankrupt you. And there'll come a day of calamity where you'll cry out and God will not hear you. Now, that's the end result of taking these other steps. It's built into the system. So if you decide to decide for yourself what is good and evil and not listen and walk with the Lord, certain things are going to happen. Difficulties are going to take place. And God is not cursing you. He's explaining to you that this is the curse of going down that road. He's not condemning you. And so the desire for a husband is what the woman shall have. But she's not going to get that. She's going to get a man who wants to rule over her. This is not carte blanche license for a man to rule over a woman. It is explaining how it's going to work. He's not going to be your husband. You're going to long for that, but instead you're going to get a ruler, a dictator. And we could go into all the Hebrew words that are used there, and it's very interesting. There's lots of different words that are translated ruler, and one of them is Shemresh, and the other one is Shemreshresh. That's two reshes, different kind of ruler. One is a Shemresh ruler, and the other one is a Shemreshresh ruler. Just to kind of give you a rough idea, the Shemresh ruler speaks to you and shows you the way, like Moses was supposed to do. But the Shemreshresh ruler uses his staff and makes you do it. And that's not a across-the-board explanation, but that gives you kind of a little peek into these letters and words. The word woman in Genesis 3:16 is actually from the word Eleph Shem Hey. It's three letters, Eleph Shem Hey. And those of you who are familiar with a lot of things that we talk about when we talk about the Hebrew language, this word, sometimes pronounced Isha, in plural, it's actually a Nun, Shem, Yad, Mem. The point of this word, Eleph, Shem, He, being woman, and it's translated wife, actually, 425 times in the Bible, and translated woman about 323 times. So it's actually translated wife more often than it's translated woman. But it's a word that has its meaning expressed in the letters themselves. And this is one of these phenomenons of the Hebrew language, is that it appears that all the letters had meanings, and they actually put the letters together in order to construct an idea, which we call a word. It's represented by a word. Now, that's not the way it works in English, in many other languages, Greek, even though we find evidence that in the Greek language there are words that seem to have Hebrew origin. based on the earlier letters. But the original letters in the Hebrew actually constructed words based on the meanings of the letters. And we'll show you some of that today. We've shown you that in the book Thy Kingdom Comes and other books that we're writing to show you how this will help you understand the Old Testament. Because there's a reason why those letters are in that word. Because that's how the word was constructed. Most language is constructed because people are talking and they create sounds and these sounds change over a period of time and therefore the spelling changed over a period of time. And at the end of all this, you've got a language that has no meaning connected whatsoever to the original letters because they were just sounds. But that's not the way it was in Hebrew. So anyway, going back to these words like Aleph Yod, or Shem, no, that's right, Aleph Yod Shem, another word, which we see translated in that Genesis 3:16 into the word husband. Here it's actually contracted from another word, which is Aleph Nun Vav Shem, and which is translated man some 520 times. And certain, meaning like a certain man, 10 times, and husband, only 3 times. That the there's another word that's translated husband about 69 times, and it's normally translated men about 1,000 times. But that it's actually two different words that are translated into these different words, like Aleph Yod Shem is 1,000 times translated into man, but 69 times translated into husband. So this connection of translating the same word into man or husband is because of the fact that it is a natural state for a man to be a husband. But a husband is not the same as a ruler. That's a different word and a different idea. And if we go down to some of these words, like, let's see if we can take the word Aleph Shem He, which is that Isha word, which we see translated into woman. We look at the letter Aleph, and it means father, son, begin. It's a paradox of God and man. The and it also has the meaning of an ox or a bull or a strength or a leader or someone who is first. And is actually composed of two Hebrew letters, a Yod and an Aleph. Or no, a Yod and I'm going to make it. The Aleph is composed of a Yod and a Vav. I'm going to get you even more confused. But anyway, it has a Yod on one side and Yod on the other, and this Vav in between, and Vav is always a connecting word, so it's connecting two Yods. One of them is higher than the other, so one of them is God and one of them is man, and now you have a picture of Michelangelo's picture of God reaching out to touch man's finger. That's an Aleph. Yod on one side, man on the other, and this connection between. It's God and man connected, the Aleph, as it was in the beginning. We walked with God. In this word, we also have a Shem. And that Shem means kind of an eternal flame bound to a coal of divine essence. And, of course, that's what the Vav normally does, is it connects two things. But here it's talking about connecting the Aleph, this relationship of God and man, with a third thing, which is the letter He. And letter He is always an emphasis word. And actually, I just noticed in my notes I've got this wrong, but that He is a word that is usually, like I say, an emphasis word. It expands upon that, the fullness of that relationship of God and man. And that's what we're dealing with when we're dealing with this word of woman being this kind of completion of this original two letters that has to do with men, but they change the third and it becomes something else. Oh, anyway, I'm fixing my notes as we go along here because I didn't realize I had gotten that. I put the wrong letter in there. But anyway, it's Elif Shem Hey. So the most common word for husband and for man is this other word, Elif Nun Vav Shem. So they both start with this Elif, but they have some other letters in it because Elif is this relationship of God and man connected. But the second letter is this Nun, which means heir to the throne. In Aramaic, it actually, the Nun is also composed of like two letters or two ideas, which is a Mem and a Nun. And it's moving, what it is like a fish moving in the water. It's man in his natural element. And the Vav, again, is connecting that original Elif, representing man, to this position of dominion connected to this Shin, which is this eternal flame, this coal or divine essence. And this is how they get the word man and husband, by connecting these letters. And as if you start laying these out and looking at these letters and word after word after word, and I've actually got several places in that I can show you where there's a particular word like Ami, which is in Hosea 2:5. You see this word where it says, actually in 2:1, the first verse, it says, "Say ye unto your brethren, Ami, and to your sister, Ruhamah." And so you think there's a brother named Ami and there's a sister named Ruhamah. Problem is that the word there is actually just the word Ami that is translated people 1,836 times. And one time in Hosea 2:1, it's translated Ami. So why is it translated, you know, almost 2,000 times it's translated people, but one time it's not translated, but they just put the word Ami, and they do the same thing with Ruhamah, because Ruhamah is, it's normally a word that means compassion or almost a piteous love or, you know, a love that comes from feeling this compassionate mercy on somebody. And that, but they don't translate it. They make it a name of somebody. And it's, and if you read it in context, it's Hosea 2:2. It goes on to plead with your mother. Plead, for she is not my wife, neither am I her husband. Let her therefore put away her whoredoms out of her sight and her adulteries from between her breasts. Verse 3, lest I strip her naked and set her as in the days that she was born and make her as a wilderness and set her like a dry land and slay her with thirst. Sounds like a bad thing. He's saying something about plead with her mother because she's not my wife and I'm not her husband. But who is he talking to? Ami and Ruhamah? No, he's talking to the people. And he's talking to their compassion. Why? Because they set up a system based upon that which we see set up at the time of Jesus Christ, the system that was set up in Ur, the system that was set up in Babylon, the system that terror was setting up in Haran, which was a system of covetousness, where the citizenry, the people of a nation, because the word is also translated nation about 17 times, this Ami, were setting up a system whereby they coveted their neighbor's goods and they set up a ruler who could take and take and take and take so that they could be benefited. And Jesus said, you have seen the Gentiles, their government, the government, the rulers of the Gentiles who call themselves benefactors but exercise authority one over the other. This is such a common theme throughout the Bible. And he becomes their husband, this ruler. He becomes their father, their caregiver. And they become his servants, his merchandise, his human resources. Now, that comes about because of a characteristic in man himself to rule over others. And while a man is to be this Shemresh ruler of his family, he is not to be the Shemresh ruler of his family. And a woman is given this weaker stature because it is tempting man by her nature to rule over her, to intimidate her, to make her do what he wants her to do, to exercise his will upon her instead of walking with God. He begins to become her God, her director, instead of leading her as his sister to God. He wants to become her God. He wants to become her ruler. And this is one of the great temptations, and we'll see when we go into the New Testament how this is very common. This is one of the great temptations to exercise authority instead of exercise the wisdom of God. To rule, become this tyrant. And, you know, I've said we have a couple programs on man and woman, and I'm sure I can't ever remember what I say in these things, but I don't have to remember it because I'm saying the same thing over and over again. It's the same principle because it's written in me already. But this idea of woman being given to man so he has somebody to boss around is not what it is. It's so that he will learn not to boss somebody around, but to be like God and rule with love and wisdom and righteousness, that he will just stand in righteousness, and this will become the righteousness will rule the woman's heart, not an authoritarian dictator. So anyway, I was going to tell you also, if we look at that word Ami, you know, it's just two letters. It's an A-N and a Mem. But if you add a Lamad to that, A-N, Mem, Lamad, the word that is people becomes toil, labor, workmen, because you added a Lamad to a word that normally means over 1,000 times it means people. Almost 2,000 times it's translated people. You know, sometimes it's translated nation, like I say, 17 times, and folk twice. It's got a couple other translations, but it's basically always people. But if you add a Lamad to it, it becomes this laborer. If you don't add a Lamad, but you add another letter, Semach, which is the eternal circle, it has to do with cycling over and over again. Then it becomes the word load, or laid, or born, or burden. So the same word, just by adding one letter, it could mean trouble or labor or workman. But by adding a different letter, it becomes the load itself, the burden. Okay, and now if you add a different letter, like a kuf, instead of a lamad, then it becomes a word that means deep or profound as a verb. But if you're using it as a noun, it means a valley or a lowland. If you're using it as an adjective, it means something in depth or deeper or strange. So this is how they change the meaning of words, by simply changing a letter. And we're going to see how important that is in the days to come. But I'm just giving you kind of a peek at it. But we're going to get into this topic of husband when we come back to Keys of the Kingdom.
My name is Mark, and I'm from Melbourne in Australia, and I'm a minister in the church established by Jesus Christ more than 2,000 years ago. After reading the books published at hisholychurch.org, I realised that mainstream Christianity had taken a wrong turn by forgetting what Jesus said to do. to practice pure religion while remaining unspotted from the world. What does this mean and how is this done exactly? You'll find out when you go to hisholychurch.org and discover what it truly means to love God and your neighbour as much as yourself. Join the Living Network at hisholychurch.org.
Have you ever looked at the things happening in the world today and felt that something just wasn't right, but couldn't put your finger on it? Have you ever heard the phrase, "God bless America," and wondered to yourself, does he really? Or have you ever looked at the government's policies on things such as abortion or same-sex marriage and asked yourself, how could they? Or where are all the Christians voicing their outrage? These are hard questions that many people today ask themselves. But along with those hard questions come some very hard answers. Answers that you may never heard before, but nonetheless will answer these and other questions you may have. So if you're looking for answers, join us at hisholychurch.org. It's not what you might think, and it will open the heart and mind to a whole other world that you never even knew existed. It did for me. And many others. I know it will for you as well. So join us as we seek the kingdom of God and His righteousness at hisholychurch.org.
The Creator is the God of the living, not the God of the dead. His kingdom was, is, and will be forever on earth as it is in heaven. Start by connecting and finding other kingdom-seeking families on the His Holy Church Living Network. Visit www.hisholychurch.org to start your journey back to your unalienable birthright.
I'm Brother Justice, and I'm a minister of His Holy Church of Sacramento, California. His Holy Church is a powerful weapon in the hands of God. The books, The Covenants of the Gods, and Thy Kingdom Come has changed the course of my life forever. For those of you who are truly looking for the way, I encourage you to look to His Holy Church at www.hisholychurch.org. May the good Lord bless you and keep you.
Hi, I'm Brent. I'm a contact minister for the Living Network in Northeast Missouri. You're not the only one out there with the desire to learn the truth. There are people all over the world coming together in faith, hope, and charity. Join us at one of the upcoming gatherings to meet new people, fellowship, work, and play. Whether it's the Fall Burning Bush Festival in Oregon or the Spring Gathering in Northeast Missouri, you'll get all the details when you join the Living Network. Go to hisholychurch.org and click on the network link. Find out what you've been missing. You'll be glad you did.
Well, welcome back to Keys of the Kingdom. Yeah, we're talking about this idea of husband, and we're going to get into a lot of New Testament references. There's actually several Old Testament references that we can talk about also. One of the things I want you to understand is that this idea of husband and what it really means, having to do with this natural relationship of God and man and this divine spark and coal that lives in us, this relationship with God, that we are not husbands unless we have the character of God in us. We're not husbands because somebody made a paper and said, you're her husband, you take this woman for your husband and for your wife and those terminologies that we see in legal documents. That's not what makes you a husband. Not in the sense that we see in the Hebrew language. What makes you a husband is that you are like God in that you are a giver of life. You are a promotion of fruit in your wife, which doesn't mean just children. It means actually you make your wife fruitful in the ways of the Spirit, because you're ruling in your household like God rules. like Moses was supposed to rule, like Christ ruled. And we'll see this reference. And there, again, there's this cognitive dissonance that we have these preconceived notions that keeps us from understanding exactly what that means. We just don't quite grasp what that means when we're talking about this idea of husband. And, you know, we start talking about this cognitive dissonance. I noticed in the news again today, there's more talk about school violence and gun control and things like that. There's probably going to be a lot of that as time goes on. And there's always these levels and levels that they want to take that to. And I was talking to somebody from Brazil yesterday morning. And he was amazed at the fact that all of our cars out in the driveway and in town, like in Paisley, the town, people have their keys in their car. They're just sitting in the car and the car's unlocked. And he was saying, well, if you're in Brazil, and he lives in a small town, he doesn't live in Rio or something, not a real small town, thousands, I think he said 5,000 people live in his town. He says that anywhere in Brazil, if you leave the keys in the car, it will be stolen. Somebody will take it. And so I asked him, because this was a topic, it was in the news, and I said, so what do you guys do about gun control? Can you own a gun in Brazil? And he says, well, yeah, you can own a gun, but you have to do psychological testing and all this kind of stuff. So you can get it, but it's not easy. So he says, most people don't have guns. It's very hard to get them. And I says, well, that's why you can't leave your keys in your car. There you go. I guess because you're unarmed. You can't protect your property. You can't even protect your own life. So therefore, you're subject. You're in danger. And actually, I looked up the statistics just coincidentally about a week or so before about the number of stabbings in Brazil. The stabbings are unbelievably. Lots of people killed with knives. And the statistically, you know, some of these statistics about all the people who are killed with guns in America, they are counting when a policeman kills somebody, too. That's gun death. Even if a policeman shoots him, it counted as a gun death. So we have this tendency, oh, these are all these criminals out there murdering people. No, these are gun deaths. And even there, most of those gun deaths are like gangbangers shooting each other. It's not people, you know, like in the community I live in, everybody is armed to the teeth. I mean, they don't carry guns around all the time. Some do. Some have guns in their pockets at church. But almost everybody in the community has a load of guns, and they're often loaded in the house. And it's very common out here to go in a house and see a loaded gun. It's just everybody's got them. We live a long ways. I mean, the nearest police station is 75 miles away, and the last burglary we had, they wouldn't even, you know, nearby to my house. And it ended up, the burglar was the son of a reserve deputy. But they wouldn't even come out and investigate. It was too far. The only crime we had, they wouldn't come out. But so people have become pretty independent about, you know, you don't dial 911, you dial your neighbor. And that's just kind of the attitude, because we're out here, and that's the way it used to be everywhere in America. But we can leave our keys in the car. We haven't had an armed robbery in this valley since 1957, and the guys never made it out of the valley. They got stopped by men with guns, because it's your responsibility to be the hue and cry of your society. You are to tend to the weightier matters of law, judgment, mercy, and faith. You are to come to your neighbor's aid. That's part of loving your neighbor. And if you don't have a gun, you can't come to his aid. Unless you want to just run out and get shot by somebody who has a gun. And so if you want to know where most of the gun violence is, it is where they have disarmed the people. Because all the criminals have guns. You know, places like and it gets worse and worse. Places like Washington, D.C. and places like Chicago. This is where that's taking place. Out here, we don't have murders out here. Very seldom. I mean, it just doesn't happen because everybody's armed. Now, it can happen. We actually had a gun death where somebody from out of town was going through a barbed wire fence to go hunting ducks, and his shotgun fell over and shot him, and he bled to death. But he evidently didn't know how to use guns very well, and that happens. And there was a drunk guy once who shot his own son because they were doing fast draws, supposedly with empty guns, in the house while they were both drunk, and the gun wasn't empty. But that's not cause, that's not the gun. I saw the guy a couple of minutes after it happened, and he was driving down the road just as drunk with a car. And that's what happens when people are foolish and irresponsible. And it could happen, I mean, nothing more dangerous than a car. So, but there's a cognitive dissonance in this country that think, oh, let's create gun-free zones around our children, which is where all these mass murders take place, is in the gun-free zones. And they keep doing it. And they said, shouldn't we get rid of all the guns? Even if it just saves one life, isn't it worth it? No, because it's killing people while you're saving one life, maybe, somewhere, way down the road. You already know it's a failed system. Gun-free zones don't work. Gun-free zones are stupid. Gun-free zones kill people. They put people at risk, the most innocent people at risk. And yet they keep doing it. They're killing people. They're responsible for the deaths of those children. Because it's like if you sent somebody out in a rowboat on a lake where the wind blows, and you didn't let the children, we're going to have a life vest safe zone. Life vest, somebody drowned with a life vest on because they got it on backwards once and they drowned. So we're not going to let people wear life vests anymore. We're going to send them out in a rowboat on a windy lake without any life vests. That would be considered a crime. But you will send your children to a school that is a gun-free zone with nobody there capable of protecting your children. Nobody. Israel had the problem and they solved it. But there's a cognitive dissonance. This is what we're really discussing here, is they cannot see the obvious reality there. They go with this blind mindset. But if we get rid of all the guns, like it's going to happen, it's not going to happen. You're not going to get rid of all the guns. A lot of those gun deaths are policemen shooting people. Now, if only the policemen have guns, you say, oh, well, the policemen are good, aren't they? Well, they were good in Germany. And they rounded people up and killed them. And policemen change. And you can hire different kinds of policemen. The reason you have guns is for the protection of your society. And anybody who wants to take that away wants to take away the protection of your society. The problem is you're already doing it. You're already turning the responsibility of protecting your society over to men who exercise authority one over the other. And Christ said you are not to do that. And now you want to do it more. You cannot be a gun control advocate and a Christian. They don't mix. Those are two cognitively different ideas. I'm going to tend to the weightier matters of law, judgment, and mercy, and faith, but I'm going to give the responsibility of tending to the weightier matters of law, judgment, mercy, and faith to somebody else. You can't do both. You either tend to them yourself, or you give the responsibility to somebody else. And Christ said, you were to tend to it. You were not to give that responsibility to somebody else. So you can't say, I'm going to follow Christ, but I'm not going to do what he says. Those are cognitively dissonant ideas. They conflict with each other. Now, understanding that, let's go on to looking at this concept of husband. Because there is a huge cognitive dissonance in understanding what the relationship, the natural relationship of man and woman. Now, I already done a couple of shows on, and you can see them linked to on our wiki site, and you can get on the Living Network, and somebody will show you where they are. But now we're going to talk about, okay, you're a man and you're a woman. now you have a relationship of husband and wife. And the interesting thing, in the earlier part of the show, we showed you that the same word translated husband is the same word translated man. And the same word translated woman is the same word translated wife. We just have two different words for that same idea, because they're one and the same. If you want to be a good husband, you have to be a good man. You have to be a real man and not just a male. If you want to be a good wife, you can't be just a woman. You have to be this wife, this good woman. Because there are women that are not good women, and they don't make good wives. And there are men that are not good men, and they don't make good husbands. And it's all the other words and where those words are located in a sentence that tells you what the heck they're talking about. So in Corinthians 7, we see, now concerning the things whereof I wrote unto, ye wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife. Let every woman have her own husband. That's very clear directions. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence. He's to be her benefactor. And likewise also the wife unto her husband. And wife hath not power over her own body, but the husband. And likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body, but the wife. So she has power over him. She has a right to decide some things that he can do and not do in relationship to his body. She has that right to decide. It doesn't mean that she rules over him and says, oh, you got to do this for me and you got to do that for me and all that. But there are certain things he cannot do unless she gives him permission. Certain things. And we'll explore that. Let's back up a little bit. Let's get some more groundwork here so that we understand what we're talking about. In Hosea 1:11, going back to the Old Testament, it says, then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together and appoint themselves one head, and they shall come up out of the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. What are they talking about? The day of Jezreel. Another one of those words that they don't translate. Creates confusion. And Jezreel means God sowed. Great is the day that God sows. Scatters seeds. Well, your seeds. So great is the day that he scatters seeds. Well, let's go back one from, that's Hosea 1:11. Let's go back to 1:10. Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as sands of the seas, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my children, there it shall be said unto them, ye are the sons of the living God. So something changed. Somewhere along the line, and we go back earlier in Hosea, we'll see this, but we just don't have time to go through the whole Hosea. And that's what we may start doing, is taking one chapter of one book at a time and going through it so that you start seeing these and not jump all around. But for the purposes of the topic of today, why were these people not his people, and now all of a sudden they're going to be his people? Because of what they said, or because of what they're doing? Because their sacrifice is acceptable, or because it was rejected? Now, your sacrifice is never going to be enough, and that's why Christ came. But it doesn't mean that you don't have to sacrifice. Because he said himself, you have to give up your life that you have life more abundant, and to give up your life is sacrifice. To care about your neighbor as much as you care about yourself is going to take sacrifice. So there's still call for sacrifice, but your sacrifice is not enough, but Christ will be enough, but you have to repent and turn around and start being like Christ and following the ways of Christ, or you're not saved. You're just deluded. And we have to be very guarded, because he said a strong delusion will come. A lot of people will think that they're saved, but he's going to actually tell them, get ye from me, because of what they're doing. What they're doing is a work of iniquity. It is not strengthening the poor. It is not being fruitful. It is being the antithesis of what Christ said to do. And we have to guard that we are not doing that, or we will be cast out. Go back to Hosea 1:9. Then said God, call his name Laomi, for ye are not my people, and I will not be your God. See, he had said, and you see this word, Laomi. And what is that? That's this word, Lo-Ami, Ami, people. You are not my people. That's what he's saying. But there will come a day when he says, you are my people. So what do you have to do to become his people? You have to become husbands. You're reading John 4:17. A woman answered and said, I have no husband. Jesus said unto her, thou hast well said, I have no husband, for thou hast had five husbands, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband, and that said thou truly. So who do you have? Now remember that this word husband also makes reference to governments that become the husband of the people that are in that government. This husband has to do, if you go back and some of the words it has to do with husbandman, has to do with plowing and tending the fields. So who is tending the field of the people with the people as a crop? Well, that's not really a husband. It is simply devouring them. It is making them weaker. It is producing a vile crop. He is genetically modifying you as a people, so that you're going to become something other than made in the image of God. And he is doing this with his social welfare programs that have become a snare. So anyway, going back, who is your husband? How can you be a husband and have God as your husband as a nation if you're not husbands to your wife? Because everything is like, you know, repeat of the same principle. If you look at a little atom, it's like a little universe. And billions of atoms produce a solar system, and billions and trillions of more atoms produce a galaxy. And then there's a sea of galaxies. And now we have the universe. But it's repeating some of the same principles over and over again. So where can we do something about the whole world? No. You do something about the whole world by doing something in the relationships you can do something about at home. It starts at home. Your relationship between husband and wife. Your relationship between you and your children. Are your sons your sons? Are you being a husband and father? Those almost the same thing to your sons and to your wife. So, like I said in 1 Corinthians 7, it says that for a man, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, avoid fornication. Let every man have his own wife. Let every woman have her own husband. By having that one and the same and not five different ones, you can start working out your salvation with fear and trembling, because you have to deal with that relationship. You can't just jump to another one. And if you have jumped to another one, okay, that's not the one you're in now. The one you're in now, you have to do right by that. If you have children elsewhere, well, that creates even more of a problem. But these are burdens that you are putting on. You have changed the first letter of the word of what you're doing. And now it becomes a burden. You change the precept because of your choices. And now what should have been a blessing has become a burden. How do you get it back to turn it into a blessing? By carrying the burden, taking the responsibility. The wife hath not power over her own body, but the husband. And likewise, the husband hath not power over his own body, but the wife. Defraud ye not one the other. Defraud thee not. Don't cheat. Except it be with consent for a time. Now, it doesn't mean you can cheat for a time. but don't deprive except by consent. And we talk about this on these, like the vow of the Nazarite. People don't realize it, but a man who took the vow of the Nazarite wasn't to go near his wife while he had taken the vow, 3 days, 3 weeks, 3 months, whatever it was. He had to ask his wife for permission to take that vow because he wasn't going to go near her for that period of time. And when she granted it, then he could do that. She couldn't go back and say, well, no, I changed it. And so, you know, it's this kind of power over each other doesn't work without love and patience, which is why God constructed it that way. It's a place for you to practice patience. And with some men, women get a lot of chances to practice patience and vice versa. And practice love and practice forgiveness. But this is the realm in which you do it. And if you cannot do it there, you cannot do it in the rest of the world. And they go on to tell you that over and over again in the Bible. Verse 6, but I speak this by permission and not of a commandment. He's not making commandments. He's trying to express concepts here. For I would that all men were even as I myself, but every man hath his proper gift of God, one after this manner and another after that. And a lot of people say, well, that Paul was unmarried, but then there's a lot of evidence that says he was. And so let's not, he's not even saying this is a commandment. He says, I say, therefore, to be unmarried and widows is good for them if they abide even as I. And this is one of the reasons why some people think he was married and became a widow. But if they cannot contain, let them marry. Don't commit fornication. For it is better to marry than to burn. And there's a double meaning there too. And unto the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, let not the wife depart from her husband. But if she depart, let her remain unmarried and be reconciled to her husband, and let not the husband put away his wife. You know, in the Mosaic, not Mosaic, but in the Quran, a man may fairly easily divorce his wife, but then he must take care of her as if she were his mother. He must provide for her needs as if she were his mother, but he can no longer sleep with her. He has to take care of her every need. This is a tremendous burden. But guys don't do it. they don't divorce. You know, of course, now they do just as bad as Christians do, interpreting their Quran, so they find ways of getting around that. But I want you to understand these things, and we'll talk more about this in the next show, Keys to the Kingdom.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.